De ese tipo, el analista norteamericano Alex Maine dice:
el derecho que existe en este caso es el derecho imperial. En todos casos, no se trata de derecho internacional, en el sentido de que eso fue una decisión totalmente unilateral que no fue aprobada por las Naciones Unidas ni está basada en alguna resolución del Consejo de Seguridad de Naciones Unidas.
El diputado venezolano Aristóbulo Isturiz subraya el papel que desempeñaba la empresa petrolera PDVSA cuando Estados Unidos tenía gobiernos serviles en Caracas.
PDVSA era un caballo de Troya en la OPEP. PDVSA era el gran instrumento que tenían para debilitar la OPEP, y así lo utilizaron. Por eso cuando llega Chávez, el barril de petróleo estaba a $7. Era aumentar la producción y bajar los precios.
De nuevo, el abogado y analista internacional Raimundo Capci.
En el ámbito internacional, unas sanciones impuestas por un gobierno a otro país más allá de su frontera en forma extraterritorial, me parece a mí que es absurda. Sin embargo, hay una intencionalidad política más allá que la intencionalidad económica. Quieren poner a nuestro país de rodillas frente a los intereses del imperio de turno.
El diputado venezolano Isturiza habla de la larga historia de agresiones contra patriotas venezolanos que pretendían controlar la riqueza nacional.
Aquí el petróleo siempre ha traído golpes. ¿Qué pasó aquí con el 50-50 de Rómulo Gallego? El derrocamiento de Gallego. ¿Qué pasó aquí con la reforma petrolera del 43 con Medina? La derrota de Medina. ¿Qué pasó con Chávez con la ley de hidrocarburos? La nueva ley de hidrocarburos de las leyes habilitantes. El derrocamiento de Chávez por 24 horas.
Capci agrega que en realidad se trata de acciones encaminadas a sembrar el terror en países asociados a la nación persa.
Las decisiones y estas sanciones son efectistas y son para amedrentar y sembrar el terror en Venezuela y en muchos países que de una manera u otra comercian con Irán.
El analista norteamericano Alex Maine apunta al hecho de que esta acción ocurre en vísperas de una elección presidencial que los demócratas quieren ganar, y al tiempo que la administración Obama tiene fricciones con importantes sectores judíos. Por lo tanto, estas sanciones parecen encaminadas a cabildear a Tel Aviv.
Hacer estas sanciones es manera de decir, pues, estamos todavía apoyando las posturas y las políticas que promueven la gente de la derecha de Israel, pues primero reforzando estas sanciones contra Irán, también atacando de cierta manera a un país que ha tenido vínculos importantes con el gobierno de Irán. Es el caso de Venezuela.
El canciller venezolano Nicolás Maduro.
La relación con Irán es una relación de paz, de hermandad, de construcción de un nuevo mundo. Y la vamos a seguir profundizando. Ahora, más que nunca, vamos a profundizar la relación con nuestros hermanos de Irán, como una demostración de que nuestros pueblos tienen dignidad.
El abogado y analista internacional Raimundo Capci.
Ya fenecido la Unión Soviética, muerto Bin Laden, necesitan de un nuevo enemigo. Y me parece a mí que este enemigo lo puede escoger Estados Unidos, o bien dentro de las filas de la OPEP o la OPEP misma.
Era el abogado y analista internacional Raimundo Capci. Por otro lado, una persona perdió la vida durante una explosión en la refinería del sureño puerto iraní de Ahadán, justo cuando el presidente Mahmoud Ahmadinejad visitaba las instalaciones. El gobernante salió ileso. En febrero de 2007, William Lothar y Colin Freeman reportaron en el Sunday Telegraph de Londres que la central de inteligencia norteamericana estaba financiando grupos armados dentro de Irán. El periódico londinense aclaró que si bien esa información fue ofrecida por un ex agente de la CIA que pidió anonimato, su historia fue corroborada por Fred Burton, ex empleado del Departamento de Estado norteamericano en Los Ángeles. Yo soy Fernando Velázquez.
Estás escuchando el Informativo Pacífica. Si deseas comunicarte con nosotros, puedes escribirnos al correo electrónico pueblossinfronteras@gmail.com.
Members of Congress, I have the high privilege and the distinct honor of presenting to you His Excellency Benjamin Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel. Thank you.
Los partidos demócrata y republicano volvieron a demostrar su apoyo incondicional a Israel, el principal receptor de ayuda de Estados Unidos. Israel recibe cada año más de 3.000 millones de dólares en asistencia militar, así como otra ayuda económica, mientras en la Unión Americana se despiden miles de maestros y se recortan fondos a programas sociales en medio de la recesión económica.
Israel has no better friend than America. And America has no better friend than Israel.
El martes, en su comparecencia ante las dos cámaras del Congreso norteamericano, el primer ministro israelí Benjamín Netanyahu dijo que Estados Unidos no tiene mejor amigo que Israel e Israel no tiene mejor amigo que Estados Unidos. Subrayó que la seguridad de ambos está íntimamente vinculada. A lo largo de su discurso, los congresistas demócratas y republicanos le aplaudieron de pie en decenas de ocasiones. Netanyahu afirmó que Israel no entregará los territorios palestinos que ocupa desde 1967, como sugirió el presidente Barack Obama hace una semana. Negó el derecho de retorno a sus tierras de millones de palestinos que sobreviven en campos de refugiados por 44 años.
Jerusalén must never again be divided. Jerusalén must remain.
Además, rechazó la división de Jerusalén, a la que llamó la futura capital de Israel, aunque los palestinos reclaman Jerusalén Este como capital de su futuro país. Sin embargo, el político derechista aseguró que Israel está dispuesto a realizar concesiones dolorosas para alcanzar la paz. «Vamos a ser muy generosos en el tamaño de un futuro Estado palestino», afirmó. Benjamín Netanyahu desconoció además la unidad alcanzada por las facciones palestinas Hamas y Al-Fatah, dijo que Israel no negociará con terroristas.
As we share their hopes.
Cuando el primer ministro israelí alabó las protestas en el Medio Oriente demandando democracia, desde la galería del público una joven judía americana gritó alto a los crímenes de guerra de Israel y la ocupación, alto al apartheid. La joven de nombre Re Avilé, integrante de la organización Código Rosa Mujeres por la Paz, asegura un grupo de hombres con identificaciones del grupo cabildero israelí-americano AIPAC la callaron tumbándola al piso.
You can't have these protests in the farcical parliaments in Tehran. This is real democracy.
En respuesta, el primer ministro israelí aseguró que la protesta de la joven en su contra demostraba la democracia real que existe en Estados Unidos en comparación con la falta de democracia en Irán y Libia.
Es muy irónica que él dijo eso justamente cuando le estaban atacando, asaltando, llevándola al hospital y arrestándola, y tiene que confrontar un juicio.
Medea Benjamin, cofundadora de la organización Código Rosa, dice que Avilé enfrenta cargos policiales por conducta desordenada y por interrumpir al Congreso norteamericano. La joven judía estadounidense Re Avilé dijo al informativo que continuará sus protestas.
I made this statement because I believe that it is very important right now to stand up against the occupation. I'm outraged at what is happening inside of Gaza in the West Bank.
Levanté mi voz porque considero muy importante rechazar la ocupación israelí. Estoy indignada por lo que ocurre en Gaza y en Cisjordania y Jerusalén Este. Es tiempo de poner un alto a las demoliciones de casas palestinas. Es tiempo de detener los asentamientos judíos. Es tiempo de detener los asesinatos de niños. Y creo que ahora más que nunca es importante solidarizarse con el pueblo palestino. La razón por la que protesté en el momento en que lo hice fue porque el primer ministro estaba diciendo que los jóvenes en otros países como Egipto y Túnez están exigiendo democracia. En ese momento sentí que era mi oportunidad para solidarizarme con los palestinos. Al mismo tiempo, como una joven judía, es muy importante rechazar la ocupación porque los valores de mi religión me enseñan a ponerme del lado de la justicia y eso hice en el Congreso estadounidense. Mi religión enseña paz y amor por toda la gente, aseguró la pacifista.
Yes, I will continue to stand up. I think this is very important that we are not afraid and I'm not alone. I want you to know that the night before.
Rey declaró al informativo Pacífica que sabe no está sola en su protesta por la forma en que el gobierno israelí trata a los palestinos. Dijo que el día anterior 5 manifestantes interrumpieron el discurso de Benjamín Netanyahu frente a la reunión del Comité de Asuntos Públicos Estadounidenses, Israelíes e AIPAC. Ellos también fueron golpeados, señaló, y una mujer fue asaltada sexualmente por protestar contra la ocupación. La joven afirma que continuará firme en su exigencia de que Israel termine con la ocupación de Palestina. En tanto, la activista Media Benjamin afirmó que el discurso de Benjamin Netanyahu ante el Congreso norteamericano muestra que es Israel quien no tiene voluntad para la paz.
Netanyahu llegando aquí diciendo lo que dijo es la barrera más grande por cualquier proceso de paz. Vino por la conferencia anual de PAC, pero ya juntaron una visita a la Casa Blanca y al Congreso, y es el solo cuatro jefes de Estado en la historia de los Estados Unidos han hablado frente al Congreso más de una vez. Así que es muy, muy raro. Y las otras personas son personas como Nelson Mandela, un ganador del premio Nobel, otra gente que han hecho algo para la humanidad. Y Netanyahu, ¿qué ha hecho? Nada, por el contrario.
Dijo que también el presidente Obama se contradice cuando defiende el derecho de Israel a la autodefensa, pero niega el mismo derecho a los palestinos, cuyas armas no tienen comparación con las 200 bombas atómicas que posee Israel.
Es otro ejemplo de la hipocresía, porque dijo, por ejemplo, el presidente Obama que cada país tiene el derecho de defenderse, y luego al mismo tiempo están diciendo que un Estado supuestamente libre de Palestina no tendría el derecho de defenderse. No, pero también hay que reconocer que eso es en el contexto de defenderse. ¿Cómo se puede defenderse de Israel, un país que tiene unos por lo menos 200 bombas nucleares? Imposible.
Benjamin destaca que cada año el gobierno estadounidense entrega de manera incondicional miles de millones de dólares al gobierno de Israel. La Cámara de Diputados de Brasil aprobó una reforma del Código Forestal que representa una flexibilización de la ley y que, según sus autores, protege a los extensos bosques del país ante el avance de la agricultura. La reforma, que ahora tendrá que pasar por el Senado, fue impulsada por el poderoso sector agrario que busca ampliar las tierras para su producción agrícola y se queja de los requerimientos de las leyes ambientales. Por su parte, defensores del medio ambiente aseguran que el código se flexibilizó demasiado y que, contrario a lo que se afirma, no se recuperará suficiente superficie de bosques, sino que impulsará un aumento de la deforestación que volvió a dispararse en los últimos meses. La Policía Federal de México informó haber capturado a los presuntos responsables materiales e intelectuales del crimen del hijo del poeta Javier Sicilia y 6 personas más. Se trata, asegura un comunicado oficial, de Julio de Jesús alias El Negro Radilla, considerado el jefe del cártel del Pacífico Sur en la ciudad de Cuernavaca, y 2 cómplices detenidos en Veracruz. Esas detenciones se suman a las de otras 4 personas capturadas en las últimas semanas y a la del jefe de policía de Cuernavaca, detenido por dar supuesta protección a Radilla y a su grupo. Julio Hernández, abogado del poeta, dijo que esperan la detención sea un precedente para que se investiguen los miles de casos irresueltos en México. Afirmó que al escritor Sicilia le gustaría entrevistarse con el supuesto homicida de su hijo. Las autoridades de Cuernavaca atribuyen unos 400 homicidios en esa ciudad al cártel del Pacífico Sur, incluyendo a decenas de víctimas decapitadas y colgadas. Tras el asesinato de su hijo, el poeta Javier Sicilia ha conseguido convocar a 2 multitudinarias manifestaciones para pedir a los grupos criminales el cese de la violencia y al gobierno panista cambiar su estrategia militar para enfrentarlos. La guerra contra el narcotráfico, lanzada por el presidente Felipe Calderón, ha dejado a casi 40.000 asesinados. El poeta Javier Sicilia y otros familiares de víctimas de la violencia tienen previsto iniciar una nueva marcha el 5 de junio desde Cuernavaca y recorrerán 2.000 kilómetros hasta Ciudad Juárez, la ciudad con mayor violencia del país. Hemos llegado al final de otra edición del Informativo Pacífica. A nombre del director del proyecto, Fernando Velázquez, se despide Norma Martínez. Gracias por su atención.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
And that was Informativo Pacífico, and it was put on a little bit late, so my show is beginning a little late. You are tuned to 101.1 FM, Santa Cruz, Free Radio Santa Cruz, and it's also a stream on the freakradio.org address, www.freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norris. The name of the show is Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. And I'm here for the next 2 hours. Going to be doing a special interview with Bob Opper Westort of the Coalition on Homelessness in San Francisco on this last weekend's Sit Live protests in San Francisco and in Berkeley, which I went up to check out, came in the aftermath of, and ended up doing a sort of a secondhand report on, which you're hearing tonight. I'm also going to be doing a little reading from the Randall Amster book, Lost in Space, The Criminalization, Globalization, and Urban Ecology of Homelessness. Plus, of course, your phone calls at 427-3772, 427-FRSC, plus numerous tidbits from the news media that interest me, and whatever else pops up in my mind and in yours. So stay tuned, and I'll keep talking.
Can't take anymore. The wind is unkind, and it weighs on my peace of mind. All my trials soon be over, free from the cold. There inside my shelter for my soul. She keeps me warm and free from harm. Deep in the arms of her love, she heals the pain. I will remain safe in the eye of the storm. Of time. If I'm out of her side, I'm out of my mind. My world is in flames. She falls like a gentle rain. Take the clouds from my horizon, clear my domain. Yeah. keeps me warm and free from harm. She heals the pain.
And that was a number from Voice of the Homeless, the particular voice of the homeless was, well, actually the name of the song is Eye of the Storm, and the voice was, Wayne Nelson and Jim Stutter wrote the music and lyrics. Who knows who did the lead vocal? I guess Kerry Warren did, for all of you who are interested. In any case, kind of a nice low-key kind of quality there. So, welcome again to my evening show, which I do once a week. Morning show also on Sunday once a week. And I'm probably planning to be taking more time out of Santa Cruz on personal quests, and who knows, maybe even some, civil rights look-arounds elsewhere, up north, up in the Arcata and Eureka and that area. Who knows? I'm pondering my options here. If I do, I'll be playing some older shows, which are also accessible online, but I want to apologize to everyone for the Huff website not being up. Huff is the Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom website, which has countless old shows that I think have a lot of valuable material in them. Though it's hard to say what will come in handy when, and it's not too well categorized and itemized and filed, but it's good to have the voices of people on the street accessible, at least in theory, and that's where they are once the people who are hosting this website actually get it back up again. I keep getting promises that don't get fulfilled, and I'm really sorry about that, but I guess people really are overworked, and we're talking volunteer work here, so it's, it's a situation where you do what you can. If people are interested in accessing old shows, you can also do it without going through the website, which is not available, the Huff website. And if you're interested in that or have any other questions about this show which you don't want to raise on the air, you can do so by giving me a call at the Huff line, the line for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, 423-HUFF, H-U-F-F, 423-4833, and I will respond to your call. But, of course, more desirable still is for you to call on the air and make this a more vibrant, flashy, contemporary, and immediate show by giving a call here at 427-3772, 427-FRSC. So you might consider doing that during the show if you have something that you think has come to mind, if you have an objection, you have a question, you have a different point of view, or if you have an announcement you want to make. If you want to actually contribute to free radio generally, or you're interested in getting a show of your own, you have a public service announcement, you can call the message line, or you can go more directly to the website itself, which you may be listening to even as I speak through the website, which is freakradio.org, www.freakradio, one word, small letters, .org. So give that a try if you're interested in learning more about the station, checking out the schedules, perhaps getting a show of your own on the station, which is happening all the time. So, get to it if you're interested. So I think it was last show, which was a shorter show. I did a two-hour show, and then I played an old show because I had to get up to San Francisco and Berkeley, or I wanted to check out these Sit Live protests, which I ended up not really getting to. I got to the aftermath of them. But I was in the midst on, I believe it was last time or the time before, playing a bit of a street encounter with officers Winston, Forbes, and Warren, who are kind of the three perennial stooges on Pacific Avenue, who run around enforcing the, or drive around usually. They don't do much running. They walk around and they mostly drive around and then double park their cars, blocking a lane of traffic on Pacific Avenue to harass homeless and poor people who are, oh, I don't know, sitting next to a building, for example, the Borders building that was closed. And I talked a lot about that and played some tape about that as I kind of roundly castigated Officers Warren and Forbes for wasting taxpayer money, harassing homeless people, taking away from police activity elsewhere, and also bullying in the most annoying way. Annoying isn't quite the word. Intimidating is a better word. And actually, a passerby who actually used to be a critic of mine joined me in this concern and denounced the officers as well. And I was glad that that was happening, frankly, because while it's, you know, supposed to be de rigueur and pro forma and the right thing to do to stand up for our police force and all that sort of thing, and I hear Steve Plaich doing that, for instance, and kind of feel disgusted when it happens. He's an activist who I have a lot of respect for, but he also is a guy who kind of tries to play both sides against the middle in the sense that he forms alliances with other groups, which I find are really highly questionable, such as conservative Take Back Santa Cruz groups. Alliances is not quite the word, but he wants to appear electable in the next election. And often people who do that get, you know, they have to pay homage to the police force. I don't think paying homage to the Santa Cruz police force is a good idea. And I don't want to really accuse Steve of doing that too much. But it's a temptation that people have because, oh, yes, I have a lot of respect for the police, but there are a few bad apples. I don't have a lot of respect for police who are enforcing these kinds of ordinances. And I don't think I really have a lot of respect for the Santa Cruz Police Department either. And I don't mean to say that just to start throwing mud at a group of people in uniform because they haven't wear uniforms. But it's based on my experience with the police force. It's not always true. And as for individual people behind the uniforms, every person is different behind that uniform. And there's no question about that. And every situation is a little different. But unfortunately, there are some really marked regularities and similarities that keep coming up when you're enforcing unjust class-based laws. And that is what happens in almost all police departments. It is my supposition and to some extent my experience. I can't speak for all police departments, obviously, but a number of them that I've seen in operation. But it is also, it's something that I find we have to combat in any way we can. So anyway, what we're tuning in on here is Officers Forbes, Warren, and, well, it's the aftermath of a harassment episode the Sunday before last at Ronnie Curry's Meal, which she does every Sunday afternoon in front of the now vacant Borders building. And there's people being hungry these days. There's a much longer line of people waiting, and they take their food and, horror of horrors, sit down next to the vacant Borders building on the broad sidewalk where they're not blocking anybody and attempt to get a moment of peace to satisfy their hunger. What do they get? Well, they get Officers Forbes and Warren coming over and harassing them, threatening them with tickets, talking about what the law is, and so forth. And the irony, not the irony, but the reality of this, and it was, ironically, it was exposed by Officer Warren, who himself tried to dispute my concern that there wasn't a complaint about this situation, that they were just operating on their own. He tried to show me what the complaint was. And there was a complaint, but it wasn't a complaint about people sitting next to a building. It was a complaint about people blocking the sidewalk, which may have been the case briefly for a moment, but not intentionally, because there was such a long line. But by the time these two police officers got there, Forbes and Winston. The line had lessened. There was considerable space. There was no further blockage. Nonetheless, they spent a good 15 minutes with their car blocking one line of traffic and a second car and then a third car, police car showing up to question and then, as I said, read the riot act to a couple, one guy named Paul and then a woman who I believe also speaks up on this little bit of an interview that we have coming up. It's not much in terms of the tape that we have, but that was the situation, and it perturbed me. And I, as I often do, spoke out about it in sort of circus barker tones, inviting the public to come over and witness the misuse of public funds, the misuse of police authority, the misuse of the authority of the city council to harass poor people in Santa Cruz. And let's hear a little bit about that.
You should be ashamed to take your paycheck.
I think that's a good idea.
This is a proposal by an elderly resident. The guy said, who's not always my best friend, that he was really outraged at what the police were doing, and he thought we should take the pictures of the police and post them in different places. And actually, this was done way back in 1992. I did it. I took a picture of then-officer, soon-to-be detective, and finally promoted to sergeant, Lauren Butchie Baker, who was accused by the Commission for the Prevention of Violence Against Women, that's a city commission, as well as a number of homeless advocates, as well as 10 women, of groping them. And the result of all this, of course, was the guy was promoted. He was declared Officer of the Year. The district attorney found nothing to charge him a criminal with. I think there was also a grand jury finding and either a state attorney general finding or an IA, an Internal Affairs Professional Standards finding, exonerating Sergeant Baker, who was then Officer Baker. However, I've had a lot of experience with Officer Baker, not in terms of his relationships with women, and this is not an attempt to go after Baker particularly again. I don't even know if he's still on the force. He's still around town, I believe, and, you know, well, we're all Santa Cruzans here and there, and, you know, should have a right to, do have a right to be in the community and are members of the community. But those of us who are who abuse the authority, and those of us who use our uniforms, and particularly the higher-ups who cover up this kind of crap, really get under my skin, and also I think need to be exposed, which is what I do. And we did this by photographs. We had a wanted poster out for Sergeant Baker. Somebody wheat posted wanted posters of Baker all over the city, and the police were running around fastidiously scrubbing them away. I've also done a show, and there is a show, and there is audio tape on the city council that was in 1992. Their bearing of this issue, though there was a great public outpouring against the Sergeant Baker's being maintained on the force while he was being investigated and so forth. Anyway, the idea of photographing police officers and putting out wanted posters, if they are accurately and specifically charged with abusive behavior, I think is quite appropriate. It doesn't happen much. It happens a little bit. I've put out a couple wanted posters on a couple people in the past, and I think, who knows, I think a wanted poster has probably been put out on me at different times, although not by federal agencies trying to bring me down here in the Santa Cruz area. Anyway, here's some more of the Sunday Before Last downtown.
That's right. I mean, they should be embarrassed to come down here and tell their wives, I gave out a ticket for two people. Who the fuck is that? Fuck you! Who's that?
I have no idea. Pay no attention to him. Keep him with what you're saying. That's more important.
Heaven on earth. Why are you whining?
Pay no attention to him. He wants to bait you, whoever he is.
Shut your goddamn mouth, you stupid bastard.
Hey, man. Good to see you again, Robert.
All right.
Come on with Cassandra. You have some stuff to say.
Yes. I think we should have a sit-in here on the app.
I like
with
that.
Everybody, with all the homeless people. Everybody's homeless. Come sit out.
Organize it, I'll come along, and we'll all get tickets.
Yeah, for sure.
We should, you know, we have a Huff meeting every Wednesday if you want to come. Are you going to organize it and bring us to your meeting, or just tell us when you're doing it?
That's what we're going to discuss when and where. Well, we want to do it right here in front of Borders. Borders is a closed business. So this way we're not disrupting the business or life or whatever. And as long as we're all peaceful and everything, they have no reason to mess with us.
Except to give you a ticket for sitting on the sidewalk.
Yes, and this is so dumb. And what are they going to do, write over 100 tickets for everybody that's here sitting on the sidewalk?
They might. I mean, I'm not saying they wouldn't, but they might. They might not, you know. I've gotten my share of these tickets, and I don't mind getting them, but people should know in advance, and if they're willing to do it, I say, right on. Then you want to have a strategy for what happens. You come back and do it again, or you just do it once as a media opportunity, that sort of thing.
Right. We should take a stand for this again.
Take a seat.
Because it's selective. If a yuppie was sitting down... If a yuppie kid was sitting right here, just sitting there, they would just politely tell them to leave. They would not just sit there, bust out the book, and start asking you for your name and your ID, like they did with me. Didn't tell me to get up.
Also, you weren't blocking the sidewalk. That was the reason they were called. He called in to get to find to hear on the play on the radio why they were called here. They were called on the complaint that there was a blockage of the sidewalk. No way could you have been construed as blocking a 25 or 30 foot wide sidewalk by sitting next to a closed building. I mean, that, or a vacant building, you might even say. So that's interesting.
Exactly. That's what we don't want to do is block the sidewalk, and yet we have to stand 14 feet away. So what? That's
seven of these squares.
Yeah. Two, three.
And she's pacing it now as we.
Right here, I'd be blocking the sidewalk.
Yes, and you could go sit in the street and block the street. How's that?
Yeah. Well, okay. So that's what they rather us do, be in the fucking street all the time.
Or next to the curb where you can breathe in the healthful exhaust fumes of the vehicle.
Exactly.
Or block the cars and doors as they open up.
Yes.
Well, it's all part of a grand plan to help you out. Way out. Far out.
Oh, out of town, yes.
Well, I don't want to suggest that the Santa Cruz City Council and the police department want to do that.
I noticed. They want us gone. Sorry, we're here whether you like it or not.
Indeed. And we've been talking with?
Cassandra.
Thank you, Cassandra.
And it's an interesting idea. In fact, there have been mass sit-ins way back in 1994. And I played the audio of those sit-ins, and there's a video, which I hope to post online, if the Huff website ever returns, which shows the May 1994 sitting ban protests against the first sitting ban. Santa Cruz was, it was either the first or second city. I think Berkeley passed such an ordinance too, a milder sort. Santa Cruz passed a citywide sitting ban, and people began sitting down in protest. Police began arresting, and they arrested about 40 people, and then they stopped. And the police were so frustrated, they began hitting at people with their batons. They had a little mini riot. This was under Mayor Scott Kennedy and Police Chief Jack Bassett. And broke one guy's leg, his ribs, that's it. And also caused a woman to miscarry. But as far as I know, there was no legal response or even change in police procedure that came out of this. But the one result was that the sitting ban was apparently judges took notice of all this crap. Or they suddenly decided they reread the Constitution and they overturned the sitting ban as being too broad. And I think it was also a defect in the warning, at which point Kennedy and Rotkin and Matthews immediately passed another sitting ban, which led to our current law. Originally, it was only, I think, for a forbidden zone of 6 feet out, and that was expanded to 14 feet in 2002. In 2003, a move-along law was added. In 2009, further forbidden zones were added, and, of course, last year, areas were completely closed after dark that had traditionally been protest zones like the city hall and the library, where it's legal, it would have been legal to be and to sit down. Then it wasn't even legal to stand. They made those changes. All of this in a sort of a ham-handed, arrogant, presumptuous attack on a small band of protesters, Peace Camp 2010, some of whom have been convicted of lodging. We talked about that on the air because they simply stayed day and night at a location with signs and with sleeping gear because there was no legal place for them to sleep, and they were also trying to bring their issue to the politicians at City Hall and at the county building, at the courts. The county building being right next to the courts where they sit, where Peace Camp 2010 at its camp. So, that was a little of what happened there. One of the things that Officer Winston kept saying, or maybe it was Officer Forbes, is make a complaint if you want. And I do make complaints. Usually I make them very vocally and very publicly in order to have the citizenry make a decision immediately on the spot whether they think the police are acting in a rational, sensible, humane, and cost-effective way. What the police want you to do, of course, is send a complaint through their own professional standards unit, which will almost invariably find them not guilty of anything. Although it is true that making a complaint can be effective in having something on an officer's record that a complaint happened. And then if somebody else goes to court and wishes to look up who the witness is as to who the complaint were, they can bring those people into court as to challenge the credibility of the police officers involved. But it's a pretty small payback for a lot of energy, although I think it's appropriate to do it, too, because I think it tends to act as a minor deterrent on police misconduct. Not much of a deterrent, really, but a minor deterrent. I don't think police officers like to get complaints, and it does have the effect of making them a little more cautious if there are more complaints out there. Probably more effective are the widespread video aspects to cell phones and video cameras, which essentially can put police in a position where their conduct is being recorded, and that becomes documentary evidence of whatever they're doing. And that's true, of course. It was the reason the Oscar Grant case resulted in a extremely rare prosecution of a police officer, Johannes Merzeli, for the murder of Oscar Grant III, though he wasn't convicted of murder, but of, I think, manslaughter, and he served a very short term, I guess a year. He's coming out in June, a year and a half maybe, and that's a matter of some concern to Berkeley activists, and not to mention to Grant's relatives and friends and family, that somebody who shoots someone else can get out so quickly, particularly if someone with a position of authority does that. On with the show. Here's more from the street.
So I have an anonymous report from a woman who said there was an attempted rape on the levee.
It was ugly. It was halfway.
It was halfway.
She was ugly.
It was getting ugly. This was a Hispanic fellow with a hoodie, a white hoodie, according to what this woman said.
Behind the bank.
And it was behind the bank.
Behind
the bank, near where the old drum circle was for a while. And what time of night was this?
What
fucking night? I don't know. We're trying to. So, in any case,
this is simply for
public information, and this is while the churches and shelters were closed.
White hoodie, Hispanic, short, sounds like an animal. You should tell
me. Hispanic and short. Anyway, more later on this, reports on assaults as they happen. Thank you. Sorry about that. The potential victim has suggested that the church should open its doors at night to women who need their protection.
Get real.
Thank you. The second suggestion is there be a campsite or campground where people can watch each other's backs. So we're talking with a potential organizer of a sit-in demonstration, but you said that things have changed in the last 8 years?
Horribly changed. This place used to be the place to be. We had hippie corner, punk rock corner.
This again is Cassandra, now the woman who spoke so forcefully after being harassed and ID-checked by the police for sitting next to the Borders building, I guess while eating part of the Rene Curry fellowship meal Sunday before last.
And comfort corner, and we all used to hang out in our corners and do whatever. We didn't.
So they cornered you, of course.
Well, yeah, but I mean, no, that was our choice. We can be anywhere we wanted on the app. They had benches everywhere to sit on. It was the place to be. The place to hang out was down here. I mean, if you didn't hang out in the app, you had a dog. You couldn't be on the app, but pretty much it's the way it used to be.
And when you came back, you found what?
That this place still had changed. Nobody hangs out down here. My friends are all gone. The ones who I used to hang out with every day down here. I mean, I expected a little bit of that, but I didn't expect the place to be complete, everybody to be gone. Like, you can't sit down here anymore. You can hang out.
Were your friends still in town but not downtown? Or?
A few of them. Not very many.
Why have they left? Are they all drug abusers or jailbirds?
Some of them.
Can I put some of them on?
We've been talking with Cassandra. From court. Well, it's Sunday, so he came from court a couple days ago. But he has Lyme's disease, and he was smoking some marijuana in the park with a prescription or a recommended marijuana use, presumably. Is that correct?
Yeah.
As a recommendation. And there were apparently cigarette butts. Which park was this?
This is Neary Lagoon.
Neary Lagoon, and there were cigarette butts.
Where do you have a radio program?
I do. When do I have it? It's on Sundays from 9:30 to 1 in the morning. And Thursday, 6 day, I'll give you my card.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so you were then found guilty. You say, as you left the court,
I took my little paper and I hurled it into the ground.
You littered, in other words.
I was rather furious, and I really wanted to go back and apologize to the judge because she has a creepy job. She has to deal with really people that aren't doing very well in their regards to their concept of law and order. And so she has to decipher all the stuff for everybody. But
you are too generous. We're switching to slow speed.
But we were switching to slow speed pretty quickly, so let's take that again.
Emotion. I've changed my mind about
apologizing to her.
That's because he's too slow.
No, I mean, I just felt really stupid about my behavior.
Because she's really not, you know. What about her behavior in sensing you to guilty?
Exactly.
She should, you know, get some therapy, perhaps.
No. It's
we're talking about Judge
situation that we
Basket.
Have in such a crazy world where the people that, you know what, this whole thing with law and order, this is just to keep the poor people from killing all these people.
That's what religion is for.
Well, that's what all this is for.
A little doesn't know that.
You know, the weird thing is, there was a gentleman that had been in court earlier, and part of his defense was he had been accused of running a light. Well, he had done the math on how long the light stayed yellow and between four blocks over on 41st. And there was a huge difference in between a four-block period as to how the lights were.
Lyme's disease hitting again.
Yeah, this is Lyme's disease at its finest.
Well, you also mentioned you met a very nice guy at the recycling center, a nice police officer, who...
Not the center. When they were giving me my ticket, it was an officer, and I explained to him that I'm over 60. I don't get any sort of, you know, social services. I don't get welfare, food stamps. I'm not legally allowed to. I got in trouble with marijuana.
A felon, man.
I'm a convicted felon, presently serving probation.
Marijuana felon?
A marijuana felon.
Not the worst kind. I don't know if I should talk to you.
You know what? I had to serve time in jail. In jail for marijuana. This past within 3 years. That's a little extreme, I think.
What kind of marijuana did you
It was incredibly potent marijuana.
So you were hooking the kids at the high school, eh?
No, actually, you know what? The kids were doing it long before I got involved in this.
you were corrupted by the youth.
No, actually, I was corrupted by the aged. Yes, I was a child when I read Allen Ginsberg, and he smoked pot.
So it was these faggots who turned you on to marijuana.
Faggots.
Faggot poets did it to you.
Faggots. And I grew up around all kinds of famous homosexuals.
There you are.
You know,
ruined your life.
Sam Houston Johnson has a brother.
You Lyndon Johnson.
Lyndon Baines Johnson has a brother.
Probably.
Sam Houston.
Had a brother.
You're going to have to delete.
This is all going to be deleted.
Yes.
You better listen now.
Sam Houston Johnson is Lyndon Baines Johnson's brother.
Yes.
And he has an illegitimate son. His name is Rodney.
We'll leave Rodney out of this. I'm not sure what relevance this has to anything. What about the recycling and the officer?
The guy that gave me the ticket was an incredibly responsible and respectful human being. He could fully relate to the fact that I didn't have a job and I wasn't making a mess.
But he gave you a ticket anyway. Why was that?
He had to because Dan Cole, the city employee who works for the city.
Who is not a very nice guy.
No, he's a creep. I'm sure that... No, I won't say.
Secrets here. Go ahead.
This is an interview. We'll have to do this again.
You're doing okay. I mean, you were saying the cop was a nice guy.
The cop was totally respectful. Unbelievable human being. And he really had no desire to give me a ticket for that at all. You know, I mean, I really wasn't bothering anybody. It's 4 a.m, you know.
How many cans did you attempt to recycle?
Oh, I probably had a dollar or two's worth, you know, stolen from the city.
Stolen from the city.
You know, this hurts the city. I mean, I don't think they're charging enough property taxes. Because if they're really worried about poor people getting bottles and cans out of the dumpsters, something's really wrong. Because there's property in this town that's worth a lot.
You don't want, you know, bearded weirdos breaking into the dumpsters, sir.
You know what? I cut my beard off. You've got a nice beard there.
Oh,
I'm very self-conscious when I have a beard. I always feel like I'm the guy in the paper going, join us for Thanksgiving dinner. And I am. That guy.
You are that guy.
I just want us to have vegetarian dinners.
Yeah. I'm more of a carnivore, but I can appreciate vegetarianism is a choice. We've been talking with the anonymous. He doesn't wish to say. He's still anonymous. But you'll see him around. You won't know who he is.
You won't know who he is. I'll have to be on your radio sometime.
Let me give you my card. We have a final story about yesterday, the Saturday in the park.
An officer approached a girl over here and told her that if she didn't dress like a slut, she wouldn't have to worry about getting raped. Apparently, there's a lawsuit going on now where she's filed a suit against her for $10,000. But this afternoon, there was the most wonderful group of people.
Slut walk.
Slut walk down the street. It was beautiful.
Now, do you actually know that there was such an incident that happened in the park? I know there was one that happened in Toronto, Canada, but I don't know about Santa Cruz, California.
I was told by two gentlemen that this happened here.
Oh, it's a secondhand story.
It is secondhand.
Yeah, I doubt it.
But one of the guys that I heard it from is one of the more credible people around here. I've heard stories about people being dead, and the next thing you know,
there they are,
playing their saxophone again on the.
Yeah, I heard about that Peter guy.
Peter, yeah. Peter was dead.
Peter the living ghost.
Then there was Chris, Cosmic Chris.
Chris is dead, I understand.
Oh, okay, well, I
didn't go to his funeral. I heard there was a funeral for him, a memorial celebration, a memorial service. I didn't really. Yeah, Chris was harassed. I think he was harassed significantly by the police before he died.
Oh no, he was harassed, definitely. Anybody that spends any time on the street that's poor is a target for the police. There's no doubt about it. They don't know any better. It's not like it's a sadistic joy that they get. It's, you know, it's kind of like fucking with your kids, you know?
kicking the dog, him, raping the babe.
Watch the police in this town harass the most benignly, chemically imbalanced, innocent little human beings that were actually good-sized men, but they were young, and they looked dirty and filthy, and they had no shoes on, and it's raining, and there's three really large police officers cornered the guy in the corner of a doorway. He's shivering, he's freezing, and he's like sitting there, and they're just harassing the crap out, giving him a ticket for panhandling.
At
6:30 in the morning. They're
after dark, it's illegal. I'm sorry, sir.
Yeah, it's against the law. It's against the law. There's a guy that sits down here all day long with a sign.
Yeah. All day long, but not at night. It's illegal.
No, this is in the morning that I saw him being harassed.
Well, it was within 15 feet of a building, or 14 feet of a building.
Well, they had him in the corner of a doorway.
They had him cornered.
They had him cornered. And he was freezing cold, and he just had a t-shirt on. I've got on snowsuits, four pairs of pants, galoshes, and I'm cold still. My hands are wet cold. And I'm looking at this poor human being with three guys, and I came up and said, wow, what did he do that was so terrible? They wouldn't tell me. They said,
that's a privacy issue.
Sneak up behind us. And I said, that officer right there watched me ride up on you guys on my bicycle. And he goes, well, he didn't say anything to the rest of us.
I've got an answer for everything. Again, we've been talking to the anonymous, the man who says very little, a great deal, but on the other hand, we don't know.
Here we are downtown on Pacific Avenue, through.
And my apologies for the poor tape quality. That's wind that does that. Makes it kind of crackly. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. My name is Robert, and this is Bathrop Spears Broadsides, a show that discusses issues of harassment of the poor, police problems, local issues, and jumps into other things, too. Phone number here, in case you want to call in with any thoughts or objections, is 831-427-3772, 427-3772. Let's take a brief musical interlude, and I'll be back. Positive mental attitude, another voice of the homeless. And the guy who wrote that sucker is Lewis Thomas. And the guy who sung it, he actually sung it too. And a couple of other people were involved, Kevin Love Jr. And that positive mental attitude. I guess nothing wrong with a positive mental attitude. But the idea that somehow if only you just change your attitude, everything would be different is, to me, not reflective of the real situation in the world, but certainly, you know, in an individual situation, there's nothing wrong with trying to view things differently and also take different actions. Maybe you can get together with some folks who are facing the same kind of problems. Anyway, so on with the street interviews. Here's one from Thursday the 19th, about a week ago, actually.
On Pacific Avenue, Thursday, about 12:30, and we're talking with some guys who've just been ticketed by two police officers. What happened, guys? Anything?
We were just longboarding down the road, and I guess we were supposed to know that there's no longboarding allowed, but we didn't know because we're visiting.
Longboarding,
so
not skateboarding.
So we got tickets.
Now, what's the difference between longboarding and skateboarding?
The boards are different. You know,
longer board.
A longer board?
More better, more comfortable, smoother, you know what I'm saying?
Now, have you, where are you guys from?
Ceres, California.
Right, where is that for those who don't know?
By Modesto, Central Valley, 209.
And is this your first trip to Santa Cruz?
No. Yeah, it is.
I live here.
You got a warm welcome, I see.
I know.
Yeah, very warm welcome.
I live here. I feel home on board ever.
No. Little ticket for us.
Hey, tell them how long we've been here before. Like,
we've been here for 10 minutes, and then we got a ticket.
Clark went down the road.
Clark went down the road, came here.
5 minutes in, tickets ready.
You should be grateful they don't ticket you for standing on this, which is also illegal, by the way.
No way.
Yes.
Wow. And so what he was standing on, that we were all talking, me and this group of five guys with longboards, or some of them with longboards, perhaps some of them with skateboards. We were in front of, kind of slightly up from the Del Mar Theater. And there, there are kind of cement berms about 2 inches high around each of the trees. It's illegal to stand on a little cement berm, although I haven't heard of anybody getting a citation for it recently. But it has happened in the past, and that was what I was referring to when I said, watch out, you'll get a ticket for abusing the concrete.
Planters, it is illegal to stand on these 3-inch-high cement planters. This is illegal behavior in Santa Cruz.
So are there any rules around here?
They do have signs over there that talk about, but they don't give you details on where it's illegal to stand and where it's not.
Will I die?
It's toxic. You could be hurting the cement by standing on it.
No way.
I swear. What kind of cement is this? Like, from Egypt?
Well, it might be, it might disgrace the city. Somebody might take a picture. I mean, it's who knows what could go wrong here. It's to make sure you behave properly.
That's cool.
Yes, not really.
Signs
not
really cool.
No, there's no signs about that. It's also illegal to sit at a bench for more than an hour. That is Santa Cruz. And we have a hospitality. Notice how hospitable she's being here, helping out the police. That's her job, to help out the police. She has hospitality written on her shirt, but what's really is hostility to those who are in violation of the rules. With a smile. It's smiling hostility. See how pleasant she is? Similarly with Sergeant Bush here. He's very friendly as he writes you a $200 to $400 citation. I don't know what the bail is on a skateboarding ticket, but that's usually what it is in that general range.
That's crazy.
I think it's how they didn't give us any warning or anything.
Yeah.
Just right away, just ticket. Bam.
Well, they want to raise some funds. You see, you obviously are wealthier than the police officer who makes, what, $90,000 to $150,000 a year, counting overtime. So, it's appropriate that you should be paying more for the city.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, that makes
sense. Useless crime. And get money for them.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.
You see? Anyway, we've been talking with
Christian Villa,
Chris Lugo,
Fabian Rojas,
Phil Me,
Kevin Castro.
And guys, this will be
Grant Wolfpack.
And I'm sorry this happened to you guys. Here's the card for the radio show tonight. You'll be able to hear the sad story repeated again.
Yay.
Anything anybody wants to say before I move on? Or?
Hey, Santa Cruz cops.
They didn't say welcome to Santa Cruz.
I know.
This is their welcome.
Fight the power. Welcome. Tickets.
Sorry, guys.
And it's really kind of cold that kind of stuff happens, but it's important that we know that it is happening.
I'm up here in Berkeley on...
And before we get into the Berkeley scene, there's a few interviews on the street up there that I'm going to play. That was when I went up on Sunday to try to catch the catter... What's it called? Not caterpillar, catter-sitter? Citapillar, I think it was called. The Citapillar demo against the proposed sitting ban in Berkeley, and the actual sitting ban that passed in San Francisco, supported by none other than our former mayor, Mike Rotkin, and I would imagine by our current mayor, Ryan Coonerty, here in Santa Cruz. Let's go now to Berkeley.
Haste and Telegraph at the corner, the old Cody's bookstore, still has the sign Cody's Books on the store across from Amoeba Music. And I once again found the revivified table
of Russell Bates. And I'm sitting here talking to that very individual who's nursing his coffee. Hello, Russell.
Hi there, Robert. How you doing, man?
Okay.
Glad to hear it.
I see lots of new bumper stickers on your table.
Yeah, I restarted my sticker system after being somewhat disabled and semi-retired for...
Russell Bates is a kind of a longtime fixture of Telegraph Avenue up in Berkeley who has probably the largest selection of bumper stickers I've ever seen, but he kind of thought he was retiring. He's going to talk about that. And so his table's disappeared. People have been wondering why my car is not festooned with bumper stickers. Well, you may see a few bumper stickers appearing on my car again. But that one of the reasons is that Russell Bates had withdrawn from the fray, or we had seemed to, but apparently not. Here he is. He's back again. He's also a longtime People's Park activist. People's Park, of course, is the community-created park that's about half a block away from Telegraph and Haste, and that retains its reputation and its reality as a place where poor people come during the day. They're driven away at night, of course, but also Food Not Bombs feeds. There are shows on the stage, and there are also a couple of sports courts there, actually one, a basketball court. The other one was ripped up by the People's Park folks who saw it, I think, quite accurately as a gentrification activity by the University of California, which wanted to get rid of the riffraff and turn it into a sort of closed middle-class environment. It isn't. It's still a center of all kinds of counterculture and homeless folks and drug dealing and free boxes and all kinds of other stuff, which it's the nature of urban life up there, but it's sort of a free zone, and it's coming under attack again, and you'll hear more about that from Russell Bates.
About 7 months, had a back problem and a knee problem and an ankle problem and a hip problem, but the problems seem to be solving themselves a little bit.
Really? So you're feeling better?
Once in a while. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I went from bitter to better.
You're a longtime activist here at People's Park and another Berkeley issues. How long have you actually lived in Berkeley?
I've lived here since 1973, so 38 years so far.
So you were here the year they passed the Citizens Police Review Commission, or the Police Review Commission?
I think that might have been around that time. I think it might have been a little bit before my time, but yeah, when it was strong, when it was powerful, when it could actually meet not behind closed doors like they meet now.
And so you've been keeping an eye on the degeneration of the oversight system in the police department in the last 30 years?
Well, I'd say the degeneration of the system of government, both locally, countywide, statewide, and nationally.
And in Berkeley particularly, how would you, I mean, you were on this, were you on the streets living in this area, let's say, in the mid-70s?
Yeah, in the mid-70s, yeah. I got here in 73 and 70, up until probably 1980 was when things were really cooking around here. And even 80, when Reagan got elected, I remember when, was that Carter? Geez, I can't remember anymore.
Carter was elected in 76, Reagan
okay,
in 80.
Okay, Reagan in 80, yeah, I was right. I remember down at Larry Blake's that night that Reagan was elected, we thought we were all going to get carried away and thrown in jail and all that. And people were four or five deep at the bar, and people who hadn't drank in 20 years were getting drunk. Yeah, yeah. That started getting people motivated because they were so scared.
Well, I know you were involved 20 years ago in the People's Park protests against the attempt to kind of tarmac over the park with the volleyball courts was going on.
Oh, yeah, that was something. I was around when a bunch of old hippies, well, we weren't old then, we were younger hippies, tore up the parking lot on the east end of People's Park. They were going to make it a pay parking lot where it had been free for years. So we said, okay, that's not going to happen. So we just ripped it up and tore it up.
1979.
Yeah, yeah. That was when Gus Newport was mayor, and the Berkeley police were there watching us. The UC police were there watching us. And Gus Newport came to the park and sent the Berkeley police home. He said, this is not our park. This is not our problem. So, and the UC police weren't about to go against a bunch of pickaxe swinging, shovel-digging hippies who were pissed.
And So the park currently, it isn't a parking lot anymore. It is, I know it was divided into three parts. What's the current status of People's Park?
Well, the current status of People's Park is, the latest rumor we've heard is a Telegraph Avenue Business Improvement District, which is pretty much landlord-dominated, wants to prohibit food not bombs from serving in the park, so it'll be more attractive to the students. It's like they're saying, if we get rid of people that need this free food, then the problem of free food no longer exists.
Well, I know they tried to do that before. That was, I remember, they tried to get rid of the Catholic Worker when they had a meal there in 1990. And, of course, in San Francisco, there were massive attempts and brutal attacks on Keith McHenry. And it's happening even now in Orlando, Florida, as you're probably aware.
Yeah, yeah.
What is the status of this? Is there much resistance developing to this? I don't see any literature on your table about that.
No. Thus far, it's seems to be spreading by word of mouth. The activist community pretty much knows about it, but since there isn't a direct threat, and I've talked with people who are there regularly at the free meal who say that that the police haven't been acting any more weird as usual than they usually do. So apparently it was one of those rumors that's being tested to see how people respond to it.
Well, I know that there was a protest today, at least it was announced on Indy Bay, a so-called chair a pillar at the Berkeley BART, downtown Berkeley, and then five related protests over in San Francisco and one up in Portland against the laws that criminalize people from sitting on the sidewalk. I see a lot of people sitting on the sidewalk here along Telegraph. I guess that would be made illegal under this, if there is, I don't even know if they presented the ordinance. I read Carol.
No, it comes up for consulting and review of the Berkeley City Council sometime in July. Yeah, several officers have been telling people that they cannot legally sit on the sidewalk and making people move. So people and part of the group that I'm working with, Berkeley Cop Watch, have been letting them know exactly what their rights are. They've been spreading the word, and they've been standing up to the cops.
Or sitting down.
Yeah, they've been sitting down to the cops. And yesterday, some young people refused to get up, refused to move, because they knew they were within their rights. So one of the Berkeley police officers, who has been a rampant harasser of folks on the street, Officer Murray of the Berkeley Police Department, gave a young woman a ticket for smoking. It's sort of a punitive.
Nee, nee, nee.
Yeah. You can't get me on, can't get you anything legal, so I'll get you on this. So even though smoking is theoretically illegal in Berkeley, it's selectively enforced. I even got a ticket once for smoking on the sidewalk.
Are you a smoker?
I am.
Here you are with all your problems, back, chest, I don't know, ankle, all the different things you told me about. You're, I don't see any cigarettes. You do have cigarettes on you.
Yep, I do.
Peeking out of your pocket.
I do. It's an old addiction of mine. I advise everybody not to get started, because the longer you do it, the harder it is to quit. But I've heard that 21 days is enough to break a habit. So if people can do it for 21 days, they can stop.
Maybe 21 virgins with you for 21 days.
Well, yeah, exactly. There was
21 experienced sex therapists.
There was a rumor that instead of 72 virgins in paradise, it's 72 vegans, which has gotten some people a bit dismayed. But for the most part, if I was strong enough to be a vegan, I would be a vegan, but I'm not strong enough for that.
There you are. A carnivore and a smoker. We're talking with Russell Bates. So, Russell, how would you describe your proudest achievements in the last 30 years, if you've achieved anything?
Well, I consider myself fortunate to have worked with a lot of people. Standing up for Mamiya when he was about to be executed, and for Oscar Grant, and getting Messerly actually indicted for murdering Oscar Grant, even though Messerly is supposed to be out in June. And
Johannes Messerly of the BART police.
Yeah, the BART police who murdered Oscar Grant New Year's Eve a couple years ago. And keeping People's Park. People's Park has been an honest moment, and working for the people of Palestine against the oppression of the Zionist entity known as Israel. That's been a strong one that I've been working on for about 10 years. I'm honored to fly the Palestinian flag every day I'm out here. And I feel pretty good about, because everything bad that's going on in the world, there's people working to make it better. So keeping the perspective in mind is important also.
Now, when I came up here, I don't know, 2 months ago, looking for these familiar tables with all these bumper stickers, which people can find on the corner of Telegraph and Haste and downtown, sort of down. This is downtown Berkeley, isn't this? Or is this south side?
This is south campus area.
South campus area. I was told by a...
And that is on weekends, if you're interested in visiting Russell Bates' literature and pamphlet table. It's Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays, I believe, midday to mid-afternoon.
One of your associates that you were no longer doing this because you had found that the people were indifferent or hostile, and it just was not... It was just difficult to even get into the situation here. It was depressing.
Well, at that point, I think I not only suffered a physical breakdown, I think I was having a bit of a mental and emotional problem.
Midlife
also.
Crisis, Brad?
No, I'm beyond midlife. I'll be
old six, life
I'll be
crisis.
65 next birthday, but I was just getting worn down. I realized that I hadn't had a real vacation in about, I had 9 days off vacation-wise in 17 years, so, you know, I would just...
Seven months off?
Yeah, I was wearing down, I was burnt out, I was tired, and I needed to get away for a while, and I got away for a while, and here I am again.
You're back, sunburned and wizened as ever.
Yep, crotchety old guy.
Different, and now that you're back, you feel any different in terms of the way people are responding to your bumper stickers? I'll give an example of some of the bumper stickers. There's a picture of Obama with a smile, it says imperialist. Another bumper sticker says too many cops. One says fuck Israel. Here's one that I've failed to purchase but will do now, called the limits of tyrants are prescribed by the endurance of those they oppress. Frederick Douglass. My government spent $1 trillion on the drug war and all I got was this lousy police state. And there's some famous...
I don't think I did, actually,
but I'll take a look. And then there's a picture of the Statue of Liberty giving the finger to Barack Obama, saying you're really pissing me off, Barack. And the classic, fuck the police. And there's, we know now, we will know our disinformation program is complete when everything the American public believes is false. A quote from William Casey, CIA director. Certainly a misquote from William.
No, I think it was a very accurate quote of William. I think he might have gotten caught off guard on that one.
Then you have one, I oppose the death penalty except for war criminals, with a picture of someone who looks suspiciously like Mr. Cheney.
Yep, suspiciously like him, if not exactly like him.
Then there are other bumper stickers, hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today? A favorite chant of the 60s, but instead of the esteemed Lyndon, we have Barack Obama.
Yep, murderer-in-chief.
Murderer-in-chief, as you call him. Then there's a nation of sheep shall be ruled by pigs. Let us put our minds together and see what life we will make for our children. The picture of a Native American guy. Is it Geronimo?
I am not sure who is that. Let me see here.
No, it's Sitting Bull.
Sitting Bull.
The name is right there.
Yeah.
So you have a number of different bumper stickers here. And how are people responding? Is anybody buying anything? We got a bunch of deadhead bleebs here. What's happening?
Well, there are serious... Well, there are people that want some kind of bumper sticker. And the people without a specific... Well, the people with a very specific agenda come to my table. I think my stickers are powerful, honest, and true, and I've been described as harsh by some people. And I think
not
the time
local
for...
enough. I don't see much relating to Berkeley here, Russell Bates.
Well, no. You know, Berkeley is...
Something about the university?
Yeah, Berkeley is Berkeley. The university is becoming more conservative. The students are more conservative. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that the students that are entering school today who were 18 and 19 years old, were 8 and 9 years old when 2001 happened, when the Patriot Act started, when the police state got in full swing. They didn't have to hide it anymore. They just said, okay, this is what we're going to do because of terrorism. And so the police state developed from that. These kids are used to obeying. This year I've noticed more than ever how many people stop for the stoplights, even when there's no cars in sight. They'll wait for the light to turn. They've been taught to obey. They've learned to obey. So they obey.
So I've noticed that when that happened on Shattuck and I ignored the stoplight, everybody came after me. So maybe I could be a leader by simply acting like a leader.
There you go. There you go. Well, I think...
Follow the parking meters and the leader.
Yeah. You know, even though I don't enjoy Bob Dylan anymore because of his support for Israel, you know, I got to agree with this thing about not following leaders. I think everybody ought to be their own leader. That way nobody stands out too much. That way nobody gets taken away and suddenly everything falls apart. If everybody is leading, then...
Or comes together, perhaps.
Yeah. Everybody needs to learn how to follow before they know how to lead. And you get a people who have been followers turning into leaders together, then we've got something going.
Well, Russell, how can people get in touch with you? Is there any way to reach you? I know that you didn't have an email, no fax, no phone, no iPod.
They can see me on the corner.
And what
Telegraph
year, what,
and haste.
What
I'm
days
usually
are you?
Out here Saturday and Sunday. Although as the weather gets nicer, I'll be out here Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
And those are like from the hours, what, 11 to 5 or something?
Well, I come out at 10. Best time to see me not grouchy is after I've set up, so probably 10:30, 11.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, too. Good seeing you again.
And good seeing you.
Indeed. Thanks.
Talking with Russell Bates, Berkeley activist and a bumper sticker vendor extraordinaire. Loki. And Loki, were you actually at the Berkeley BART doing the chair a pillar sitting demonstration, or just hear about it?
I was there.
There was a demo down there about the sitting ban.
I was there for a second. I just went there to check it out, but pretty much what they're trying to do is the same thing that they've done in Santa Cruz and most other places in the Bay, is that no sit, no lie ordinance. And we're trying to not do that in Berkeley because this is where we live. This is People's Park, and this Berkeley is for the people, about the people.
How many people showed up that you estimate when you were there?
Probably somewhere around altogether going through 700 to 800 people.
Really?
Yes.
And how long did you hang out there for?
About 5 minutes.
So it wasn't for you? You didn't bring a chair with you?
No.
Backpack, but no chair.
Backpack and no chair.
Any hassles here in Berkeley you want to talk about?
Not particularly right now.
Any reports from the street for Free Radio Santa Cruz from Berkeley? Anybody wants to say anything?
Barack Obama, first black president of North Africa.
There you go. Well, I mean, somebody had to do it. Shall I say the House nigger did it? That's unfair because it sounds racist, but it's actually accurate.
Hey, the truth is, we're all controlled by the White House.
Yes. Well, yeah, certainly have a lot of power, for sure. Any report? What's happening with People's Park? Are there any reports on what's going on there?
Oh yeah, dude. Yesterday or 2 days ago, they were chopping on some trees.
They chopped hella trees
because they're planning on putting in a camera system that they don't want people to know about, and they want to see into the park. Even though their excuses were because they were hiding people, and people were when they were tearing out entire bushes that were shorter than me, and I'm not a tall person. And I even offered myself to trim the trees because what they were doing was just hacking up plants.
It's like how they kill the fucking redwood trees. They kill the redwood trees by cutting the lower branches off them. They need the lower branches so they can absorb
just
water.
Just like in Arcata Park up north, dude. That's just bullshit. They cut out the trees for 420 last year, and now they've been cutting down redwoods for a goddamn frisbee golf course.
They cut out four trees to build a stupid housing complex for people. They cut out two fucking oak trees, and then there was a church over here with a fucking redwood that the whole church was built around the redwood, and they cut out the fucking redwood. Cut it out in the middle of the night, pull up the stump, chopped it in little pieces when no one was around, and fucking dipped out with it.
We've been listening to the criticisms of
Caleb
and
Ace.
Thank you both. Anything else, folks?
No.
This will be on Free Radio probably on Thursday evening,
did
6
you have
to
fun
8.
Dying?
Right between, I guess, Haste and the street that's next up closest to.
And what's happening next is I saw a squad car stopped with its lights flashing. Actually, I think there may have been two of them. I think it was one or two. And I walked up there with my tape recorder to see what was happening. But I also note an email I just got. It turned out that the police were... we'll hear the report from Russell Bates. The guy is not only a bumper sticker salesperson and longtime activist, but he also works with Copwatch, which is an organization that began in Berkeley in 1989 under the leadership of a number of people, among them Andrea Pritchard, who came down to Santa Cruz the next year and did some Copwatch stuff, trainings for us. But anyway, here's an email. UC Cop confirms attack on park and Food Not Bombs. This is from a Berkeley activist. A UC cop told my friend Hawk that they're clearing out the park this summer, that there wouldn't be a homeless problem in the park after this summer. My friend Hawk looks clean, so cops tell her shit, not knowing she's a friend of activists. She works in education, so that's all the cops think she is, someone who has a job helping college students. She was chatting with the cop. She had noticed a frat guy in the hall being weird around some girls who were hiking. She said he was a pervert. The cop said it was a homeless man, probably. Hawk said it was obviously a frat guy and wasn't a homeless guy. The cop told Hawk that the students here are good kids and that the homeless people are the problem. The cop then said the park was going to be cleared, and also the hill up Dwight, the county-owned park behind Clark Kerr, was going to be cleared out. That's where many people sleep. And that's the report on an email from almost an anonymous email from Berkeley. I don't really know who it's coming from, but it's being sent to the People's Park community, which is an email group, or this is a Yahoo group online. So we'll see how that goes. I continue to look for reports from Berkeley, and if anybody has information, please do call in, 427-3772, or, for that matter, information about Santa Cruz and what's going on here. After all, Santa Cruz is where we are. Before I go on with the Berkeley interviews, I want to note a story that I found online in the Orlando Sentinel. Those of you who have been listening to my show regularly know that I've been interviewing Keith McHenry a number of times. He's the Food Not Bombs co-founder who has been standing up for the right of people to feed people in Orlando, Florida, where the courts have ruled that the city officials' attempt to cut back on the rights of people to feed in parks has been okayed by the courts, and so there are threats now to say that Food Not Bombs, for instance, as an organization, can only serve twice in 1 year in any particular park. And there are 54 parks in Orlando, so in theory they could serve, I don't know, what, 108 times or something like that. I'm not sure if I have the numbers exactly right. But, of course, the right to share free food and to share a political message with it is an important one. And so Keith McHenry, who's pictured in this online story, headed Activists Defy Feeding Rules But Still No Arrests, dated yesterday, reads as follows. Anti-poverty activists were again trying desperately to get arrested Wednesday night for feeding the homeless at Lake Eola Park so they can bring attention to their cause. I don't know how desperate they were, but Orlando officials didn't oblige them. They're trying to goad us into doing something, said Heather Fagan, Mayor Buddy Dyer's press secretary. We will continue to enforce the law, but not on their schedule. Twice in the past week, members of Food Not Bombs handed out meals to dozens of hungry people at the city's signature park in defiance of Orlando's restrictions on group feedings. On Wednesday, about 40 people quietly lined up for plates of vegan food. The group has been dispensing food every week for several years, but an appeals court ruling last month clears the way for police to again begin enforcing the city ordinance. Food Not Bombs members are hoping the police do just that, reasoning that arrests will cast city officials in a bad light. Expose the harassment, I would say, which, of course, was also the case in Santa Cruz in the late 80s and early 90s when we faced and were multiply arrested here and in San Francisco throughout the first half of the 90s. However, people standing up to this were able to essentially turn the tide, and though the rules were not changed, the practices of the police stopped arresting people, and Food Not Bombs now feeds, as do other groups in Santa Cruz, without at least immediate fear of arrest, though there are a lot of pressures on Santa Cruz food groups to get out of the public spaces, and little unofficial pressures on people like the people who were, we were feeding people occasionally at the Peace Camp 2010. We did a protest that we set up a table earlier this year, I believe it was, when we wanted to, or no, I guess it was last year at the courthouse. Huff set up a table briefly to publicize a trial where the city was spending thousands of dollars going after me, Becky Johnson, and Robert Blind Bear Facer for a singing downtown with homeless lyrics in front of the bookshop Coonerty. That's the bookshop Santa Cruz. And we had on the, we had coffee, and we had, I guess, breakfast coffee cake provided by India Joe Schultz. And we also had a little half and half on the table to put in the coffee. A deputy sheriff came over and demanded we remove the half and half from the table because it was in violation of a county ordinance. So that's the kind of stuff they pull, and they're pulling it even worse in Orlando, Florida. And here's more from that story. The group Food Not Bombs issued news releases predicting arrests at its three most recent feedings, including Wednesday night. At the first two, Lake Eola Park feedings after the court ruling, a city official filled out a permit for the group and dropped it off, avoiding arrests that would be recorded by the gathered reporters. Activists crumpled the permits and refused to accept them, but Orlando officials still considered those feedings to be legal. Under city rules, each group or individual is allowed two permits for each downtown park each year, but police still made no arrests Wednesday, the first Food Not Bombs feeding with no permit. They may be trying to avoid the publicity, but if anybody gets arrested, it will still make the news, Food Not Bombs founder Keith McHenry said. Fagan, the police department, the mayor's PR woman, said she hinted that police may gather evidence that could be used to arrest activists later, perhaps at their homes or workplaces, away from the news cameras. You don't have to arrest them on the spot, she said. There are other alternatives. And this is what, of course, was done with Wes Modes in Santa Cruz last year when he was ticketed, not arrested on the spot for walking in the New Year's Eve parade in 2009, in the DIY parade. But later, he and two others were sent tickets in the mail. And then he was tried in court with an unusual team from the city attorney's office coming in to harass and support the prosecution. And they, of course, had it been done during the parade, it might have provoked a riot. It might have provoked people to angry protest. So in order to avoid that, they do it quietly later. Sinister stuff, and shows the need for solidarity among all of us so that we know when this is happening and raise the issue. If they raise the ante, we have to be there to stand up to that kind of stuff. Anyway, I'll keep trying to keep an eye and an ear on what's going on in Orlando, Florida, and keep reading the emails and the news feeds from there. Maybe have another interview with Keith McHenry. On a totally different subject, bipartisan House resolution on Afghan pullout expected. Ooh, actually, this wasn't just expected tomorrow. We actually had it. There was a resolution expected, this is a story from yesterday. Most agree that it has virtually no chance of passing, but the House is expected to vote Thursday on an amendment pushed by Jason Chaffetz, Republican of Utah, and Peter Welch, Democrat of Vermont. The amendment would demand that the president end the war in Afghanistan. Despite the pessimistic outlook for the vote, the Pentagon and the Obama administration are expected to keep a close eye on what is seen by many as a major test of exactly how much congressional support remains for the increasingly unpopular war. The bill would amend a massive defense spending bill to demand the end of the conflict. Representatives Welch and Chaffetz are expected to draw considerable bipartisan support for ending the war in the face of soaring costs. Exactly how considerable remains to be seen. A separate amendment was successfully passed today, insisting that the bill not be construed as an endorsement of the unlawful Libya war. The Obama administration was required to secure congressional authorization for the conflict within 60 days, something neither the House nor the Senate has done. And here's the story from today on antiwar.com. House call to end Afghan war suffers narrow defeat. Massive swing from 2010 vote shows growing anti-war sentiment. Again, a story by Jason Ditz. Congress has reliably defeated efforts to end the Afghan war on the back of strong support from a number of representatives who have never seen a war they didn't like. Today's highly anticipated vote was assumed to be a defeat before it began, but turned out extremely close. Indeed, though the amendment was defeated, it lost only 204 to 215. And I'm taking a second look at that particular vote. That's pretty close. It looks like 204, I'm proud to say, or at least I would like to make clear for those who are interested that Representative Farr, let's see, Farr voted to end the war. So good for him. 204, 178 Democrats voted to end the war, and 26 Republicans voted to end the war. 207 Republicans and 8 Democrats voted to keep the war going, although the specific resolution in the House was what? The computer will keep up with my chatter, then I'll be able to tell you. There we go. It lost only 204 to 215 and carried more than 90% of the sitting Democratic representatives, with the bipartisan bill also carrying a number of freshman Republican support. A couple of shifts here or there could have actually swung the vote the other way and left President Obama's ambition to keep the war going beyond 2014 in a considerable mess. The amendment would have called on the administration to begin wrapping up the war and negotiating a settlement that would allow for a pullout. A much more aggressive version, sponsored by Representative Chaffetz, the one I think that was we talked about in the earlier story, was also voted on, failing 123 to 294. And that one probably also got Farr's vote. Let's take a look here and see what our local representative did. Yep, he got his vote. Good for him. I have a lot of criticism of Farr for voting yes on voting for ending the war and these sort of small votes. When it comes to authorizing the military appropriations, at least half the time he is there authorizing them. And that's just simply wrong and something I don't think we should tolerate. The Chaffetz Amendment was far more ambitious and would have required a full withdrawal of all U.S. forces from Afghanistan within 60 days. The closer amendment, sponsored by Jim McGovern, did not set any explicit date. The loss is still surely a disappointment, but when one considers that the 2010 vote on materially the same amendment got only 138 yes votes, there is no doubt which side the momentum is on. So a year ago, the amendment got 138 votes. This year it got 204 votes, which is a considerable advance. It also means that the 2012 vote, and surely there will be one, will not be presumed to be a slam dunk for the administration going in. The combination of the two votes also shows that the anti-war sentiment is surprisingly deep. The Chaffetz Amendment still managed to carry a solid majority of the President Obama's own party, and the McGovern Amendment came within a hair's breadth of passing. Again, the Chaffetz Amendment said get out within 60 days, and the McGovern Amendment said negotiate and get out without a date out of Afghanistan. Polls have long showed the American public squarely against the already decade-long war. Today's vote suggests that while Congress is still not caught up with public opinion, they are coming around slowly but surely. Assuming that the war continues to grow less popular throughout the year, both amendments can probably count on picking up additional support among representatives ahead of the 2012 election. Not only that, but the vote shows the Republican opposition growing largely on the basis of incoming freshmen. This suggests that, while the old hand politicians can be stubbornly reluctant to abandon an unpopular conflict they voted for at one point, as they get filtered out, this lingering support eventually crumbles. Despite administration claims to the contrary, the public opposition can eventually end America's wars. And that's House call to end Afghan war suffers narrow defeat. Massive swing from 2010 vote shows growing anti-war sentiment. And like that, yeah. Well, let's see here. There's an interesting story from Modesto, actually not Modesto, but near Modesto, Merced. Merced police used taser on unarmed, legless man in a wheelchair. And I got this story, like, today in the mail, but it's actually a two-year-old story from September 20th, 2009, but a relatively long story. I'll read a little bit of it. It's pretty grim, but this happens. It happened in San Francisco. A guy in a wheelchair got tased, actually got shot, I think, at the beginning of this year. And I don't know if we're going to have time to play Bob Offer Westort's interview. He's an activist who actually helped organize and kept a close watch on and participated in at least two of the six San Francisco protests against the sitting ban law, Measure L, that happened last Sunday. He talks about the police misconduct and the rising rate of shootings and taserings and so forth up in the city. Anyway, here's the story from Merced. The Merced Police Department's Internal Affairs Division is investigating a complaint alleging that an officer twice used a taser against an unarmed, wheelchair-bound man with no legs. The man who was tasered, 40-year-old Gregory Williams, a double-leg amputee, spent 6 days in jail on suspicion of domestic violence, resisting arrest, although the Merced County DA's office still hasn't filed charges in the case. Williams, who was released from jail Friday, said he was violently manhandled and tasered by police, even though he claims he was never physically aggressive toward the officers or resisted arrest. Even worse for him, Williams said he was publicly humiliated after his pants fell down during the incident. The officers allegedly left him outdoors in broad sunlight, handcuffed on the pavement, nude below the waist. Williams said the arrest also left him with an injured shoulder, limiting his mobility in his wheelchair. And although the two lead arresting officers are white and Williams is black, it remains unclear whether race was a factor in the incident. These two officers remain on duty. Williams said the officer never used any racial epithets towards him, although he does believe race and class played a role in the arrest. He also said the police just wanted to be downright nasty to him. They did what they did because they can get away with it, he said. They've been doing it for so long it doesn't matter who they do it to. They just think they can get away with it. A handful of residents who live in Williams' apartment complex claim they witnessed the incident and support Williams' charges. A short video clip shot by a neighbor in the complex and obtained by the Sun Star clearly shows Williams sitting on the pavement with his pants down, his hands cuffed behind his back. A Merced police report obtained by the Sun Star tells a somewhat different story from that of Williams. The report written by the responding officers suggests that police had tried to reason with Williams before the arrest to no avail. The officers that wrote in the report that Williams was uncooperative and refused to turn his two-year-old daughter to the Merced County Child Protective Services, among other allegations. In the report, police also said a hostile crowd had gathered as the officers attempted to perform their duties. The Merced Police Department spokesman officially declined to comment on the matter, saying he can't legally speak out about it because of the internal investigation. The Sun Star interviewed Williams and several neighbors who said they witnessed his arrests. Tasers have become more controversial as they're more widely used by law enforcement. Proponents, including most U.S. law enforcement agencies and related foundations, say the weapon allows officers to control suspects and criminals without resorting to deadly force, pepper spray, or batons. The stun guns, which transmit up to 50,000 volts of electricity, are supposed to disable a suspect or criminal for several seconds so officers can handcuff or otherwise control him. Tasers have become popular over the last decade, and more than 12,400 police departments worldwide use them. Opponents blame tasers for more than 150 deaths in the U.S. in recent years. A 2005 report by the American Civil Liberties Union claims the weapon is largely unregulated. In a survey of more than 50 departments across Central and Northern California, the ACLU concluded that in the absence of strong regulations on how police use the weapon, we are likely to see more unnecessary deaths. The Law Enforcement Alliance of America called the ACLU report junk science. Law enforcement agencies typically blame taser-related deaths on other factors, such as the possible lethal presence of illegal drugs, pre-existing medical conditions, or stress stemming from violently resisting arrest. A Fox News story last year quoted a study by the city of Houston that concluded its police officers used tasers more often on black suspects than any other group between 2004 and 2007. Three inmate deaths in the last 5 months have occurred in Stanislaus County Jail after correction officers used tasers to subdue prisoners. Last year, Merced County agreed to pay $650,000 to settle a lawsuit filed by the family of an inmate who died after a struggle involving correctional officers who used a taser at the Merced County Jail. And, of course, we had one guy tased to death in the county jail. I believe it was tased to death. A female deputy tased this guy. This was in 2004, 2005. I wrote a story on it on Indie Bay. Let's see if I can find it here. Maybe what I should do, though, is first finish up this story and then come back to our local lethal tasering incident as I saw it. Let's see what we got here. Williams, a lifelong Mercedian who's married with three children, said both his legs were amputated in 2004 after he was diagnosed with a serious case of deep vein thrombosis. The condition led to gangrene in both legs. Doctors amputated each of the legs below the knee when he was 34. Now only withered stumps of skin exist where his lower legs once were. Williams said losing his legs was life-changing. He lost his job as a truck driver and was forced to adjust to life as an amputee. He now supports himself and his family from a Social Security allotment of $1,004 a month from his disability. Williams and his wife have a 2-year-old daughter, Ginny, together. His 11-year-old daughter and 4-year-old son live with other family members. Fast forward to the afternoon of September 11th, a day Williams said he'll always remember. That's September 11th, 2009, perhaps. That's when the story came out in 2009. It was written September 20th, so rather in-depth reporting for a mainstream newspaper. Interesting. Between 3 p.m. and 4 p.m., Williams said he and his wife, 28-year-old Dimitris Chaurit Filer, were involved in a verbal argument when a marked Merced Police Department patrol car arrived at the couple's apartment at 2355 K Street. While one officer spoke with his wife, Williams said another officer arrived at the scene and ordered him to go back to your house. Williams, who had his 2-year-old daughter in his lap, said he rolled his wheelchair back to his apartment. The officer, who Williams said he couldn't remember by name, but is identified in the police report as Officer John Pinniger, approached him in the doorway of his studio apartment. Pinniger said his wife accused him of striking her, which Williams denied. Shortly after, Sergeant Rodney Court and a worker with Merced County Child Protective Services came to his apartment, Williams recalled. I'm trying to tell him nothing happened. We were just having an argument, he said. Williams said the officers told him he was being arrested. Arrested for what? What did I do? Williams said he asked the officers. Events went south fast. Pinniger grabbed Williams' 2-year-old daughter from his lap, handing her to the CPS officer. I said, what are you doing? I haven't done anything, Williams recalled. Williams said Pinniger, who was positioned behind the wheelchair, grabbed him by his left arm, pulling it backward behind his head. To prevent himself from falling out of the wheelchair, Williams said he grabbed the side of the wheelchair with his right hand. I wasn't resisting. I was hanging on so I wouldn't fall out and bust my head open. They weren't caring what was going to happen to me when I hit that ground, and I knew it, Williams said. Williams said Pinniger unholstered his taser and jammed it into his ribcage on the left side of his body, shocking him twice. Williams said he fell from his chair on his stomach onto the ground outside of the doorway in front of his apartment. During the struggle, Williams said one of the officers placed a handcuff on his right wrist. While he was down on the ground, Court put his knee on Williams' neck, Williams said. One of the officers then cuffed both of Williams' wrists, he said. At some point after falling out of the chair, Williams said his shorts slid down his legs. With his hands cuffed behind his back, Williams said he was helpless and unable to pull his pants back up. He said police left him for 5 to 10 minutes on the pavement in that position with his genitals showed as neighbors and onlookers watched the scene unfold. William Decker, a relative of Williams who witnessed the arrest, said he was appalled by what he saw. Williams is the brother-in-law of Decker's wife from her previous marriage. The tenants were screaming, "Pull his pants up, give him some dignity," Decker recalled. Decker said he noticed Williams was bleeding from his mouth during the incident. Williams said he's unsure of why he was bleeding from his mouth. There are specks of blood present on the collar of the blue shirt he was wearing that day. Eventually, Williams said a detective uncuffed him and someone pulled his pants up before paramedics attended to him. Dozens of police responded to the apartment complex as a small crowd of onlookers and residents gathered. Williams was taken to Mercy Medical Center, Merced, and treated for a shoulder injury, which Williams claimed was the result of the officer pulling back his arm. A diagnostic imaging report from the hospital states that although there is no fracture or dislocation on Williams' left shoulder, he may have an underlying rotator cuff tear. Williams' left arm is in a sling. Without both arms, he said he'll be unable to move his wheelchair without help until his shoulder heals, which could take weeks. Police took Filer, Williams' wife, into custody during the incident on an outstanding $10,000 misdemeanor warrant for domestic violence. A tenant in the apartment complex, 36-year-old Clifton Alexander Allison, was also arrested on suspicion of carrying an illegal weapon, a double-bladed folding knife, and with resisting arrest. After being treated, Williams was taken to the John Lataraca Correctional Center, where he spent 6 days in a dorm with other inmates. He was released from jail Friday around noon with the Merced County DA's office when they decided not to file charges against him. Merced County DA Attorney Larry Morse II said his office rejected Williams' case because there wasn't enough evidence to file charges. While we do not doubt the officers may have had probable cause in arresting Mr. Williams, in our view we would not likely obtain a conviction in a jury trial, Morse said. We are ethically precluded from filing any case in which we do not believe we have a likelihood of securing conviction. Williams said he's not surprised the DA's office didn't file charges because he maintains he did nothing wrong. While Williams said he was concerned about the officers taking his daughter away from him, he insisted that he never posed a threat to police. Other than having his daughter taken away, Williams said the worst result of the incident was being subjected to the public embarrassment of being handcuffed on the ground with his pants down in full view of apartment residents. Recounting the experience, Williams broke into tears. "How much resisting am I going to do with no legs, no feet?" he wept. "It's ridiculous what they did to me. How far am I going to run? Where am I going to go?" The Merced Police Department was prompted to conduct an internal investigation into Williams' tasing after Decker filed a complaint with the department on September 14th. Decker said he spent the weekend disgusted by what he had just seen and felt he had to step forward. The former owner of Big Will's Barbecue Restaurant in Atwater, Decker said he wanted to intervene to help Williams, but feared he'd be the next to be tased, or worse. "He didn't fight. He didn't hit anybody. Nothing," Williams said. Commander Floyd Higdon, spokesman for the Merced Police Department, said he couldn't comment on any specific details about the incident, citing the internal investigation. Although Higdon said the officers involved remained on duty, he said the department is taking the internal investigation and the allegations seriously. "We want to get to the bottom of it," Higdon said. "We want to make sure we're doing the right thing for the right reasons. But like in any case, we need to keep an open mind." In the police reports filed by Court and Pinniger, details surrounding the incident differ somewhat from Williams' account. According to the report filed by Officer Pinniger, he arrived at the K Street apartment at 3:27 to investigate a call about a fight in progress. Filer, the wife, told the officer she had been in an argument with Williams, who punched her about 3 times in the stomach with a closed fist. Filer told Pinniger she had no physical injuries. Pinniger walked over to talk with Williams, who acknowledged the couple had been in an argument about their 2-year-old. When asked if he'd struck Filer, Williams denied it, according to Pinniger's report. While Pinniger was talking with Williams, a CPS worker arrived at the scene, telling the officer she'd received information from an anonymous citizen that there was a domestic violence happening at Filer's and Williams' apartment, that there was drug use in front of the children. According to the report, Williams then became extremely upset because CPS was at his doorstep. Pinniger in court told Williams that it would be in his best interest if he allowed the CPS worker to search his home to ensure that it was an adequate place for the child to be raised, the report said. Williams told the officer he was no longer going to talk to him, saying that he knew his rights. After Pinniger told Williams he was going to have to take him into custody for misdemeanor domestic violence, Williams replied that he wasn't going to allow anyone to take his child. Court went to Williams, this is according to Pinniger, the police officer's report, of course. Court went to Williams' right side and grabbed his right arm into a rear wrist lock, according to the report. Williams began to yell, "You're not taking me to jail, you're not taking my kid." Kinniger grabbed Williams' left arm, which he had wrapped around his daughter, pulled the child away, and handed her to the CPS worker. After removing Williams' arm from the child, he then grabbed the wheelchair and refused to comply with our orders, Pinniger wrote in the report. Pinniger then told Williams if he didn't comply, he was going to shock him with the taser. Williams continued to yell and scream that he wasn't going to jail. I removed my taser from the left side of my utility belt and removed the cartridge. I then activated my taser and applied it to the left shoulder of Williams. After tasing Williams, he began to comply, and I was able to grab his left arm, Pinniger's report stated. Court, in his report, said he tried to explain to Williams that he had no intention of taking him or his daughter. He wrote that he only wanted him to cooperate with Pinniger and the CPS worker so that we can get the information that was needed and leave. I guess they wanted to search his house without a warrant. Not sure what CPS's powers are in that regard, but we'll see. The story continues. In the report, Court said his efforts to verbal judo a belligerent Williams into cooperating failed as Williams yelled profanities and refused to comply. As for Williams' disability, Court said he and Pinniger were extremely careful in handling him, putting Williams' arms behind his back before carefully removing his daughter. Court's report stated the officers did this without even having Williams come out of his chair. Neither Court nor Pinniger mentioned in their reports that Williams allegedly fell out of his chair, nor do the reports mention how Williams was allegedly handcuffed on the pavement with his pants down. While Williams said he remembered being tasered in the rib cage, Pinniger stated in the report that he applied the taser to Williams' shoulder. As the officers began taking Williams into custody, a crowd of 10 to 15 people began to approach the police. A member of the crowd, Clifton Allison, walked toward Pinniger, yelling, "Leave him alone, you bleeping bitch," the report said. Pinniger placed the cartridge back in his taser, pointed it at Allison, and called police dispatch to request backup units. Although Pinniger instructed Allison to back away, he continued to come toward the officer, shouting to leave Williams alone. This, again, is according to the police report. More officers arrived, and Allison was placed in a patrol car due to the fact that he was enticing other people in the area while we were trying to take Williams into custody, Pinniger wrote in his report. Court wrote in his report that the only visible injury on Williams was a cut to his lip, which appeared to be self-inflicted, possibly from biting it. Court's report said Williams also complained of chest pains, and Pinniger reported Williams might have also suffered a dislocated shoulder. While at the hospital, Williams, without being advised of his Miranda rights, apologized to Pinniger for acting up, saying he was only trying to protect his daughter. He also told Pinniger that he never struck his wife, according to Pinniger's report. Again, this is a report about a double amputee being tased in Merced in 2009. And apparently I've gotten into the story, so I'll keep reading some more of it. Several residents who witnessed the incident said they think the police used excessive force. While some witnesses said they didn't see the tasering itself, their account of the aftermath matches Williams' account. Eddie Blaylock, a 38-year-old resident of the apartment complex, said he was standing outside his unit with his wife, Kathy, when the couple witnessed the commotion. Blaylock said he doesn't personally know Williams, saying he's only waved at him from time to time. Blaylock, who was a member of the crowd that gathered to watch the incident unfold, said he began taking notice after seeing two cops trying to handcuff a guy in a wheelchair. After seeing an officer pull out his taser, Blaylock said he yelled, "Hey, you can't do that." One of the officers threatened to taser Blaylock if he didn't step back, he said. Blaylock said he didn't actually see Williams get tasered, although he did see him on the pavement, handcuffed with his pants down. He was handcuffed that way, with his pants down. He couldn't do nothing, Blaylock said. He was just sitting there on his knees with his pants down, not doing anything, not fighting, nothing, just staring. Blaylock and his wife said they never saw Williams resist arrest or become violent. He was complaining about them yanking his arm back before they handcuffed him because they had one cuff on him, Blaylock said. They couldn't get the other arm for some reason, and that's when the taser came in. He was yelling about his arm being stretched backwards. Farrah Shells, Allison's girlfriend, said she walked up to the scene with her boyfriend and saw Williams on the pavement handcuffed. They wouldn't even let him pull his pants up, Shells said. While Allison was arrested and faces charges for resisting arrest and carrying an illegal weapon, Shells disputes the officer's claims. Shell said Allison had been trying to record video footage of the incident on a camera phone when an officer told him to stop. Shell said Allison refused to stop filming the incident, saying, "Well, everyone else is." Shell said the officer then arrested Allison, although he didn't resist, and willingly placed his hands behind his back. In addition, Shell said she believes the police deleted the video footage of the incident from the phone. Before they gave it back to me, I saw a cop going through my phone, Shells said. When asked about Shells' claims about the phone and the circumstances surrounding Allison's arrest, Higdon declined comment, saying that's also part of the department's internal affairs investigation. Anyone who lives in the vicinity of the two-story apartments of 2355 K Street will tell you the area is known for drug sales and other illegal activity. Williams said he lives at the complex strictly out of economic necessity. He also claims he never uses drugs and only drinks an occasional beer. Before his arrest on September 11th, Williams had only minor brushes with the law. He was arrested on July 17, 1991, on suspicion of spousal abuse for an incident with his then-girlfriend. On March 27, 1992, he was arrested for misdemeanor driving without a license and a misdemeanor spousal abuse and battery warrant. All those charges were dismissed. Despite the allegations of drug use at his home, Williams has never been arrested on any drug charges. I'm not like what they say in all those reports. What they're trying to do is justify what they did to me, Williams said. Williams' daughter, Jeannie, is with his sister-in-law. He's been unable to see her since his release from jail. Higdon, that's the police department higher-up, said he's not sure how long the internal investigation will take, noting that such investigations can range from a few weeks to several months. He said the investigation will determine if the officers violated any of the department's policies and procedures and if any criminal acts were committed. The department's internal affairs report will eventually be forwarded to the Merced Police Chief Norm Anrade for his review. Decker, who filed the complaint with the police, said he's not convinced anything will come of the police investigation. As a result, he's helping Williams obtain legal advice. I don't know if the police department will do anything, Decker said, and I'm pretty sure they're going to blow it off. But I needed to do it for me because it bugs the hell out of me. For his part, Williams hopes the department will hold the officers responsible for their actions, which he considers wrong. Williams said he was afraid of losing his daughter and being knocked from the chair. If they were going to do what they had to do, just lift me out of the chair and put me in the back seat, Williams said. Don't try to throw me on the ground because I'm going to grab onto my chair. I'm not going to let you throw me on the ground and bust my head open. I don't think anybody would let them do that. He also hopes his story will prevent anyone else from going through a similar humiliating experience. If it's not me, it's somebody else, Williams said. That's the way I see it. And that's from the Merced Star from September 20th, 2009. About the police tasering a double amputee in an arrest that the DA refused to even take to court. And what I'm looking for now is to see if there's a follow-up on this particular story and whether there was any ultimate activity on it. I may actually contact the reporter. His name is Victor A. Patton and see what actually went down. Perhaps we can find it. Take one look here. I'm doing a quick search. See if there's anything that comes up. And we're waiting. Okie dokie. Well, we got a couple. Charges dropped against wheelchair-bound man, April 27th, 2010. That was 6 months later. Merced County prosecutors have dropped domestic violence charges against the wheelchair-bound legless man accused of beating his wife with a broomstick. Gregory Williams, 41, was taken into custody earlier this year for an incident that allegedly happened at his home, September 6th. This case is noteworthy because it made national headlines for a separate incident. So there was another incident of domestic violence, but the charges were dropped. It's what's interesting is not whether he's guilty or not or of domestic violence, so that's relevant certainly to people who live with him and near him, and also to whether how charges of domestic violence are treated in courts across the country. But my focus, of course, is on how the police handled this whole situation and the tasering situation. And I've done some discussion in the past of tasers, particularly in Santa Cruz, and to find out what's going on there. Actually, I think Kate Wells is involved in a case with that. It's an attorney who is also a friend of mine. I'm going to look for this, if there's any tasering stories that come up. Ah, yes. I wrote a flyer way back in, I think it was 2005, called Stop Lethal Tasering in Santa Cruz. It was September 2005. And I wrote, David Anthony Cross died after being tasered in jail last weekend. Enough. Stop taser abuse in Santa Cruz. What are sheriff's deputies doing tasering an unarmed man in jail? According to Sentinel reports, on September 18th, Santa Cruz Sheriff Robbins deputies tasered David Anthony Cross inside the Santa Cruz County Jail, allegedly to control him after he began banging his head on the cell door and acting irrationally. The five-second stun charge of 50,000 volts was applied directly to his shoulder once or twice rather than at a distance, according to Lieutenant Phil Wowak, who is now the sheriff. Move from lieutenant to sheriff. Cross stopped breathing, lost consciousness, and never regained it. His family was notified of his death Sunday night, but not that he'd been hospitalized. Sheriff's videotapes of the tasering and death have not been released, or they weren't as of September 2005. Nor have the names of the tasering officers. On September 20th, the same day the Sentinel released the study, county pathologist Richard Mason, after an autopsy, ruled the death accidental, apparently rejecting the alternative categories of natural, suicide, homicide, pending, and undetermined. According to coroner's deputy Steve Plaskett, Cross lost the ability to breathe due to chest compression during the restraint, went into cardiopulmonary arrest, then anoxic encephalopathy, there we go, or lack of oxygen to the brain. The death certificates contributing causes of hypertensive heart disease and obesity. Cross weighed 260 pounds. Amphetamine was found in Cross's system but could not be determined as a contributing cause without further testing. Taser use is not listed as a contributing cause to his death. In April, Santa Cruz Mayor Mike Rotkin, back in 2005, refused to direct the police department to open its records regarding taser use. On September 24th, the Public Records Act request was filed with the city seeking to determine how widespread police use of tasers is. And I don't think I got a response to that request. TASER is an acronym for Thomas A. Swift's Electrical Rifle. Interesting. Call Sheriff Robbins to stop taser use. I give a phone number. Call the supervisors. Demand an independent investigation. Call Rotkin to stop SCPD use of tasers. And so forth. And that's a story that's on Santa Cruz. It's not on IndieBay.org. It's on the earlier website that predated IndieBay.org/Santa Cruz. For those of you who follow my show regularly, IndieBay.org/Santa Cruz is a website, Santa Cruz Indie Media, that I usually post articles on. I was previously posting articles on their earlier site, which was called, which was at santacruz.indymedia.org. Similar, I mean, it's actually the same, but it was a different format. And a lot of older articles are available there. Probably be worth my while to follow up. I did contact David Anthony Cross's relatives at one point, and they were kind of following the case. I'm not sure what happened to him. I'm not sure what happened in the Williams case. And perhaps I'll look in again on that case on Sunday when I come back. I'm rapidly reaching the end of my tenure here at this, in this particular edition of my show. I do want to mention that tomorrow at 10 o'clock in the morning there is a trial in Department 1 of James Mattson, who is also known as James in the Rain. He's a musician and an activist who lives in Berkeley, and who was arrested at the drum circle, the remains of the drum circle that moved to the area behind India Joe's on Wednesday on the Levee Path, and still plays there. He was the last person arrested or ticketed at the drum circle that I'm aware of, and he faces a charge of being in a forbidden area after dark, although, of course, it's been true that the drum circle has regularly played after dark there, and the police have not harassed people or have... I haven't heard any reports of significant harassment in the last few months there, for which I think we can thank people like James and the Rain Mattson and Robert Blind Bear Facer, who, when told to leave, stayed there and embarrassed the police by suggesting that, you know, there was no harm in what they were doing, that they were just drumming Why were the police dispersing drummers in a very distant location? There wasn't even a complaint of unreasonable noise. The police used some Sergeant Harms, I think, in his police report, claimed that Mattson was blocking the path. Mattson told me he was off to the side, and I've usually found most of the drummers are off to the side. So that's happening tomorrow at 10 o'clock in Department 1, and I'll probably be there to check it out. I encourage you to go down and check it out, too. Charges may be dismissed if the officer doesn't show up. This is an infraction. It's not a jury trial. We do have a caller. Hi, you're on free radio.
Yes. Do you realize that by being so petty, you're actually sustaining the status quo? Hello?
Oh, I'm still here.
I mean, you know, drum circles, you know, you come from a 60s tradition of trying to create great transformation, and you come down to this. So, you know,
caller, I think the reality is that it's about public spaces, not about drummers. It's about people who want to be in public spaces, whether they're homeless or activists or drummers or shoppers, for that matter. The fact that police have these extraordinary powers is the problem we have, I'm sure, where you live down south, and certainly we have it up here in Santa Cruz.
Well, you know, down south is pretty unfathomable to you. It has about 10 million people. And it's nice that, you know, that there was a line in some Jack Nicholson movie. They said, you know, I wanted you to tell me the truth. And he said, you can't handle the truth. And I can't, and I've lived here for 40 years, and I can't handle it either. But, you know, perhaps you consider me foolish, but somehow, when you get so deep and low and specific in your endeavors, it would serve you well to raise up your vision and look at the whole picture.
I appreciate that. I am, of course,
okay.
I'm up
Thank
against
you.
The clock here.
I appreciate
here, man.
It, and it's my pleasure to have spoken to you, sir.
Sure.
And no are problem. You, by the way, are you holding Uncle Dennis hostage?
Uncle Dennis is a man who is very hard to hold hostage, but he will soon be available for you to chat with.
But he's not available tonight. He has gone on a trip.
I'm not sure. I think he's around here. In fact, I suspect this guy looks very much like Uncle Dennis.
That must be a replica and a clone, and that gets into genetic mutations, and we'll talk about it later on.
Reports of my absence are highly exaggerated.
Uncle, you were supposed to go and celebrate your niece's graduation.
Yes, but I decided that...
You wanted to have this conversation.
Yeah, I did, but I decided to make a phone call rather than a personal presence, so...
Okay, well...
I'm saving a lot of carbon emissions by not driving all the way to Oceanside.
And please play some Flaming Groovies, because
Flaming Groovies! We can manage that.
Yeah, because otherwise I'm going to perish in the night.
That I would find hard to believe.
No, sir. No, it's true. I have... My DNA has been channeled through Flaming Groovies. Okay, Uncle Dennis. Okay, Robert. God bless you all. We are the last brave survivors and warriors.
Well, actually, I'm surprised that you're still here. The rapture occurred over the weekend, and all those God-fearing Christians went to heaven.
No, right across from my abode here, there was a rapture billboard. You know, I could just, with right across the street. And I'm so... still clueless after having lived for half a century in the West, that I couldn't understand what the hell they were talking about.
Well, they didn't understand what they were talking about either, apparently. all this scientific research into the dates hidden in the verses of the Bible turned out to be hokum. Unless, of course, the whole thing's happening in October.
But you should realize the guy is basically a comedian. I mean, he has this family radio, which is a cynical manipulation of human beings. And all of this is vaudeville. In fact, I'm looking at the very billboard that had Rapture, and now it has L.A. Noir, the game. The game, this big video game that neither of us would care to play. So, you know, it goes on. It's a freak show.
Well, isn't all of L.A. a freak show?
Well, no. The billboards are, but when you get down on the street, Los Angeles, like any other big city, imposes huge challenges on people, which they try to meet, and then they are polite to each other. But beyond that, they wish to be left alone. Because there's an element of shame.
Shame for having moved to Los Angeles?
Well, there's an element of shame in trying to deal with this monster. You know, you live within a monster, and you say, hello, how are you? And then beyond that, if you want to really engage people in conversation, you know, there's a wall. Now, I had my American gestation up there, and over there people are more than willing to engage you in conversation, but then there's another kind of wall. so anyway, there are walls, but who knows? I think I'm exceeding my time limit.
Who said you had a time limit?
I don't know. I'm on the alternative Senate floor.